from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday morning, a barrage of U.S. senators hit the airwaves fresh back from Iraq. Their message was urgent and clear. Washington needs to send more U.S. troops to secure the country, and quickly. At least another division, said Senator John McCain. We are in a race against time. Today in San Antonio, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld insisted again that U.S. brass in Iraq do not want or need more troops. But if they change their mind, Washington can afford it, he said. Americans are trying to follow this debate to assess the need. In a new Newsweek poll, 48% of respondents said the United States should withdraw troops from Iraq. 47% rejected that option. Newsweek's poll also showed majority support for the idea of giving more authority to the United Nations in Iraq, an idea that Paul Bremer again rejected yesterday. Do we need more American soldiers on the ground in Iraq? Is it time to escalate the U.S. commitment or to take another path? These are tough questions. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight in Washington. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy and budgeting, military technology, and homeland security. He's also a professor at the Public Policy School of Columbia University. I asked him exactly what is driving the debate over whether the United States needs more troops in Iraq.
There are two things going on. One is that we don't really know how to calculate required forces for these sorts of missions with any great precision, and there's just no military methodology that's available to resolve the question once and for all. And for that reason, the broader point is that this then becomes, to some extent, a debate about how well the overall mission in Iraq is going, and it becomes a convenient basis on which to criticize the administration for those who feel it's not going very well, and that Rumsfeld has been so bent on minimizing American forces for the war and then for the post-war period that he has ignored military advice. So in some sense, it's a barometer or a referendum on the broader question of how well the Iraq mission is going. And the reason that second debate occurs, again, is because the first issue of how we calculate necessary forces cannot really be definitively answered by any kind of techniques we have in our military analysis toolkit.
I want to come back to that toolkit, but what about this issue of the overall referendum on how it's going? Do people feel it's going well in the Pentagon? Does Donald Rumsfeld feel satisfied with how the occupation's going?
My understanding of the Defense Department position, at least of the top civilian leadership, whether it's Rumsfeld himself or just the broader team, is that they are relatively happy. They don't feel that a lot of the good news is getting out. They think that most of the country is stable. They feel that compared to Saddam Hussein's rule, things are much better even in the areas that are turbulent. They feel that the overall prognosis is favorable, and they want to make that pitch, and they feel that they have facts on their side. I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago with a number of other think tank people and a couple of very top-level Pentagon officials we were asked not to identify, but they gave us a fairly hefty dose of this kind of positive spin, and there are some facts to support what they're saying. On the other hand, they seem to be among the only people in town who really make that argument with conviction these days.
Now, about this issue of need and calculating need, you say there's no way, there's no tool for deciding how many troops are enough. Take us into that. It would seem to a layperson that it might be obvious when there were too many or not enough.
Well, it gets obvious perhaps when you try a certain answer and then see how well it works. And I think we are getting enough information now to conclude that either we're not deploying our force very well or it's just a little bit too small. But before you start, the question is which historical analogy or which other country's experience do you use as your benchmark? Because if you look at how many forces we have on the ground in Bosnia or Kosovo or East Timor, other places we've done this sort of thing as the international community in the spirit of peacekeeping and nation building, you can get answers that vary by 50 to 100% by a factor of two in what forces are required for a given size population.
You mean in situation X it required this number, in situation Y it required twice that number?
Exactly. And even if you try to look at a more detailed level and say, well, which particular missions were needed in these countries and which might be needed in Iraq, even when you try to calculate at that level of precision, you don't do very well. So you're going to be off by tens of thousands of troops in your broad first blush guess. And this is one of the things that really in the end has to be answered by people on the ground who are trying to generate enough patrols to cover whatever targets they think are likely to get hit. That's why Rumsfeld refers back to the commanders on the ground and claims that because they're not asking for more troops, he doesn't need to provide any more. But of course, what if the commander on the ground makes a mistake? Or what if the commander on the ground is under political pressure not to increase the size of the military? Then you may not be able to rely on that particular approach either.
And this weekend, we have had top U.S. Elected officials coming back from Iraq saying we need more troops there. Senator John McCain saying at least another division. Senator Richard Lugar, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, saying it will take a concerted new plan without a number on it. Senator Joe Biden saying, I forget the number, 40,000 or more additional troops. How do you interpret politicians in both parties coming out with these kind of statements?
Well, the first thing to say, I guess there are two things to say right off the bat, which pull in opposite directions. On the one hand, these people are obviously not in a position to do detailed calculations themselves. On the other hand, the three people you just mentioned are among our three most seasoned and experienced and wise senators on issues of foreign policy. So what I'm trying to say is I think their voice deserves to be heard as much as anybody else's. And they have thought about this problem perhaps more than Mr. Rumsfeld in many ways, because these three were in the Senate through the period of the 1990s when we were doing a lot of other peacekeeping missions. They were watching them, trying to learn from them, while Mr. Rumsfeld, as he would acknowledge himself, was out working on pharmaceuticals. And Rumsfeld, like many of the Bush administration top officials, have a visceral opposition to nation building. They feel like it was a Clinton, woolly-headed, liberal thing to do. They didn't want any part of it. Of course, they've now become the greatest nation builders since MacArthur and Truman, but that's by necessity, not by choice. So in a sense, I think that the senators you mentioned need to be listened to, and Rumsfeld needs to question whether his own instincts are really correct when these senators are saying other things. There's no way to calculate the number if you're Senator McCain dropping in for a few days. He's giving an impression. He's giving a rough ballpark, and his ballpark is different from Lugar's, and it's different from Biden's, and it's going to be different from anybody else's. So we shouldn't take these numbers too seriously. But the overall sense is that the mission's not going that well. There are a lot of places that are unprotected that need to be secured. And if we don't get the momentum back on our side, the overall mission's success is in jeopardy. I think those are the central points the senators are making, and I think they're right.
Senators watch public opinion. The Pentagon must, and the administration obviously does as well. Newsweek is out with this new poll saying that 48% of those polled said the U.S. should withdraw its troops from Iraq, 47% rejecting that opinion, kind of right down the middle split in the American public. Do you think that that American polls of the electorate are going to make a difference in policy soon?
Well, not that kind of a question, because frankly, that kind of a question implies an unrealistic course of action. We can't pull out of Iraq. There's virtually no one who has thought about this very long, who has considered what that would mean, who would agree with that statement, at least not yet. It would have to be a very, very last recourse when the situation is truly desperate. When a poll questioner asks a question in that way, I think there's almost an implication to the person taking the poll that somehow we have a serious option here of withdrawal, that someone's developed this option and they're being given a choice between option A and option B. And of course, if you think there is a serious option of withdrawal, we'd all love to we'd love to invoke that option. But in point of fact, there is no alternative to American-led military force in Iraq right now, because we haven't built up an Iraqi force capable of replacing us. If we pull out now, we're condemning that country to chaos, to potential takeover by Saddam's own people or by terrorist organizations. It's simply not a serious option. On the other hand, if things get worse and if there's a point at which the Iraqis that we've been training are more numerous, maybe at that point you do cut your losses, turn things over to the Iraqis, and hope for the best. But even if things go very badly, we're not at that point yet.
And Michael O'Hanlon, you've given this a lot of thought yourself and have written about it recently. Describe for us your own view of what's needed in terms of U.S. troop strength in Iraq now and in the foreseeable future.
Well, I think the international force needs to grow a bit, although I would hope it would not be Americans, because, of course, we're 85% of the force now. That's way too much. The main thing here, in addition to training Iraqis as fast as we can, and I'm happy to see that happening, maybe it should be sped up even further, but the main thing we have to do is get more countries involved. And what that means, I believe, is going to the United Nations, asking Kofi Annan to be formally in charge of the mission, have Ambassador Paul Bremer become his special representative in Iraq, so the United States still has a lot of influence, have NATO run the military operation. So we still have an American four-star general who's the head of NATO and then an American three-star general leading the operation on the ground. We retain primary influence in the mission. We have to share a little bit of responsibility with our allies and other countries. But by doing so, we get a lot more help on the ground from other countries like Turkey, India, Pakistan, and yes, even France and Germany. But and so I think that's the way we have to go.
But you've written that even if the Security Council passes a new resolution to put the UN formally in charge in Iraq, the problem won't be solved. You've said it's still going to take more U.S. troops.
Well, what I think is it will take more American troops in the military force structure, not in Iraq. In other words, my concern, if we get enough foreign troops here in the short term, I don't think we have to add many more Americans.
So the 130,000, 100 whatever it is, right in that range is about right, in your view, in country.
I hope we don't have to go higher than that, and I don't believe we should have to go higher because we should do a lot better on the burden-sharing effort. The problem for the U.S. military, in my judgment, becomes how do you sustain a mission anything close to this size for more than about a year with the military we have, with the force structure we have. And I believe you have to avoid, at almost all costs, sending people back to Iraq in a year who have already been there once. You need to give people a longer respite before you send them back. And the USA Today story in today's paper also says that we're now thinking of sending people straight from Iraq to Afghanistan or Korea.
And these are for one-year tours, for long periods.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We have to avoid that.
So your point is just to maintain the U.S. troop presence there is going to require a larger military at home so that U.S. soldiers aren't being rotated back-to-back through hard, long duty in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right. We need a larger rotation base, and we need that even if we're able to bring down the size of the U.S. presence in Iraq a little bit in the next year, as I think we will be able to. But even if you do that, you will have depleted your force structure of all available Army units within about 12 months, and at that point you face the incredibly unpalatable choice of either sending back to Iraq people who have already been once or somehow hoping against hope that the international community can take the job over with very little American help or that the Iraqis are already ready to do it themselves. I think none of those options are realistic. So we have to get the Marine Corps more involved in the peacekeeping just as they were involved in the war. We have to get allies more involved, and we have to go to a somewhat larger U.S. Army.
Michael O'Hanlon, very quickly, do you think this is going to be won by those who say we've got enough troops there or by those who say we need to send more?
Well, I think this is one of those things where you'll at least send a few more, and both sides can claim victory. Rumsfeld can say that he held the line against those calling for 300,000 and 400,000 total international troops, which is a number you tend to hear quite often, actually, not from the three senators you mentioned earlier, but from a lot of people. And then critics of Rumsfeld will be able to say that they forced him to concede that his initial force package was too small. And, you know, if the number ultimately is just 5 or 10,000 more than we have today, I would tend to argue that Mr. Rumsfeld would be more right than wrong, and therefore he should be prepared to swallow a little bit of pride for the good of the American troops over there.
Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with me from Washington. We will be joined shortly by two former generals on the issue of U.S. troop strength in Iraq. But first, joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening, Jack. There's the issue right on the table. A lot of senators talking about it, saying we need more troops there, but Donald Rumsfeld, very firm, no.
Yes, and there's somebody else who's engaged with this, and that's Karl Rove. I think he's the key player now because these are fundamentally political questions. He's got three options. Go to the UN and NATO. Well, Rumsfeld's a problem. He says no. Increase the U.S. force size. Well, that's against what public opinion wants on one hand, and Rumsfeld doesn't want it on the other. Three, steady as you go. Well, that means more Americans killed. We're about to approach the point where more will have been killed in the occupation than in the war. Three bad choices for the president, and two of them will force him to confront the secretary. So I think it seems to me that Karl Rove is probably saying right now, Mr. Bush, come next week, General Clark is going to declare his candidacy, and he's going to make this troop deployment his central issue. We've got to have a plan B here. You've got to confront Rumsfeld or fire him.
What's Wesley Clark saying on troop deployment, Jack?
Well, I, you know, his whole position, at least general position, is we have to do everything in the world today multilaterally. So you can imagine what he's saying on troop deployment.
Well, it means the UN, but whether or not it means more U.S. troops may be the issue. Jack, stand by. We're talking tonight about U.S. troop strength in Iraq and whether it has to grow or not. Do we need more American soldiers on the ground in Iraq? Is it time to escalate the U.S. commitment. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday, a fleet of U.S. senators fresh back from Iraq hit the nation's talk shows and warned of the need for more troops to pacify and protect the country, Iraq. Here's Delaware Senator Joe Biden.
We are woefully underprepared. I think this administration, Mr. Rumsfeld, should sort of get over it and get to what they seem unwilling to do. This is like ideologies run into reality here. We need more troops. We need more cops. We need more civilian affairs people. We were woefully unprepared. I mean, there's no sense of urgency here with this administration now. And it's time for the president to go to the American people and say, look, this is a gigantic undertaking. It's going to cost billions of dollars and take more force in order to do it.
That was Senator Joe Biden appearing yesterday on Meet the Press. But Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld countered the senator today while speaking at the Veterans of Foreign Wars annual convention in San Antonio, Texas.
The number of troops currently in Iraq is the number of troops that the combatant commander, John Abizaid, has asked for. He has been told directly by the president and by the Secretary of Defense that if he believes that additional troops are needed, he will have additional troops. Let there be no doubt.
So, do we need more American soldiers on the ground now in Iraq? Is it time to up the ante, pour in more troops, or not? What is the best way forward? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Alexandria, Virginia, is retired Major General Edward Atkinson, Senior Fellow at the Army's Institute of Land Warfare and Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening and welcome, General Atkinson.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Also joining us from Lexington, Massachusetts, is retired three-star Marine Corps Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor. He is former news analyst for the New York Times and author of The General's War, The Inside Story of the Persian Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, General Bernard Traynor.
Good evening, Tom.
Yeah, good evening. Thanks for joining us. General Traynor, to you first. Do we need more U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq?
Tom, I refuse to join the chattering classes in the stands trying to second-guess the coach on the field. I have no idea, and I'm willing to accept the view of the field commander that he has enough forces. But I think that's missing the point. The point is, what is the mission, and what are the complexities of the mission that are involved? And when I look at it, I think it comes down to the requirement for more intelligence, not for more troops.
Well, chattering classes, but do you include everybody in that? John McCain, Joe Biden, Army Chief of Staff General Peter Shoemaker said recently that he intuitively thought we need more people there. Of course, before the war, General Shinseki said that it would take 250,000 troops, maybe more, 100,000 plus more than were actually sent. Are you dismissing the entire sort of view that we may need more as uninformed?
No, I'm not dismissing it. I will take the position that we were short of troops when we won the war. We had enough troops for the combat mission, but we did not have enough troops to take advantage of our aura of invincibility at the end of the war to saturate the area and keep the situation under control and maintain the initiative. We lost that. And right now we're, in a sense, playing catch-up ball, but I'm not sure that it's a numbers game. I think it's a mission game. You have to identify what's required and not just the business of willy-nilly saying that, well, we have to increase the forces. Well, what are you going to do with those forces? Where are they going to go? What is their mission? I think you have to be far more specific in what you're going to do with the forces that you have there and find out whether that meets the requirement.
Bernard Traynor, hold that thought. We'll come right back to it, but I want to ask General Edward Atkinson first. Your top-line view here, does the United States need more troops in Iraq? There are real and concrete calls for that to happen, anywhere from a division to much more than a division. What's your view?
Well, I think it's quite clear that everybody in the Pentagon, including the Secretary of Defense, recognizes that we do need more troops. The question is, do we need more American troops? They are asking and planning on having two international divisions, one under Polish control and one under a control that has yet to be established. And if we throw those in there and continue the program that we've seen scheduled for rotation of our own troops, the whole strength of the whole body will be going up. So I don't think that there's really anybody in a responsible position who doesn't think that we don't need more troops. Just for sort of a gut feeling, if you look back through our own history as to where we've encountered this sort of thing before, on this scale, you really have to go back to the 19th century and look at what we faced or what the U.S. Army faced in the South at that time. The population of Iraq is almost five times that of what the entire Confederate states were. But counting all the troops that we put down there into occupation, counting all of the state militias that were then organized because the federal force was inadequate, and then the black troops that were pulled in, they still were unable to control operations like the Ku Klux Klan and certain knights of I forget the name of the organization,
but which could be awfully disruptive.
Secret organizations that fought against them. My calculations is if you were to compare the size of the problem there and the size we problem here, we'd probably need about 273,000 troops to have the same degree of control over Iraq, considering that we seem to have an organized secret opposition. It would require almost exactly what General Shinseki set forth, which was hundreds of thousands of troops for several years.
Before the war began, that would be almost 100,000 more than now. Jack Beattie, I can hear you there, but stand by. I want to get to Bernard Traynor first on General Traynor, this notion that it's not greater numbers that are needed, but a careful definition of the mission and better intelligence. How could that take the place of additional troops? And are you saying the same thing as Edward Akeson here, that are you saying we don't need more troops, period, or we don't need U.S. troops, we need better intelligence and mission definition?
Well, I don't think that the numbers really is the way to approach the problem. And the analogy with the Reconstruction period in the South, like all analogies, limps, but in this instance, you know, it's a crippled analogy because every situation is sui generis. Let's look at the situation as it exists. The trouble is not throughout Iraq. The North is pretty reasonably under control, and also in the South. So I don't think that we should feel that there's chaos in the entire area. But now let's look at the mission. Let's look at the problems that we face.
Mm-hmm.
As I look at it, there are five sources of problem. First, there are the common criminal gangs. Number two, then there are the Baathist leftovers.
Mm.
Number three, there's the certain tribal groups that are in rivalry and pinging on one another.
Right.
And finally, or the fourth, there's the national resistors, people who just, you know, resisting.
Nationalistic.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the important one, which is the one that is growing. And that's the outsiders, the terrorist groups that are coming in, presumably supported by Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iran. Now, those are the people that are well-trained, well-armed, well-equipped, and well-organized. They are going to be the problem. The other ones we can handle, particularly the common criminal gang, can be handled by the local Iraqis when we get those standing up. The Baathist leftovers, you know, we're taking those people down.
But
the rival tribal groups are going to be a regional problem.
But if that can be handled, why isn't it being handled more effectively?
Well,
I mean, the report's coming out. You know, it's deaths every day. The UN headquarters
blowing up. Are you looking for instant results? I mean, we are in a war, and the war changes. There's
mm-hmm.
a dynamic, you
mm-hmm.
know, that people play on both sides. I'm not saying that more troops wouldn't be useful, whether they're U.S. or whether they're international. That is not the point. The point is, what is the problem? And to say all of a sudden, buy low and sell high is the answer, doesn't get you very, very far. You have to be rather precise.
So are you saying focus them on this threat of outside intervention?
That is going to be the major threat, because right now, Iraq has become the battleground in the war on terror. They're the terrorists and the institutions that exist in the Middle East that do not want the United States to succeed are going to bet all their money on this one. They have to win, or we have to win. And, of course, In turn, we make the judgment that we will win.
General Atkinson, there's a view that the real threat here is the outside terrorist threat coming across the border, others as well, but that as number one, and that if you focus strategically on that, you don't have to have another 100,000 troops in there necessarily.
Well, I think there's many people who are concerned with the inherent opposition within the country, as there are worried about people coming across the border. I don't weigh in on that issue one way or the other. I think they're all a problem, and they're a challenge to us. And somehow we've got to find a way to beat it. Now, I'm a little bit skeptical about these multinational divisions we want to bring in mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. They're not equipped up to U.S. standards. We have basically a transformational army, and they do not. They have the old 1980s army. They have little intelligence collection capability. They have outmoded communications. They have an inability to rapidly fuse the information that they do get. I think they would be
we're talking about Poles and Bulgarians and others here,
duty, mm-hmm. But far less so for rapid reaction. You've got to have a far more modern, able and agile force to be able to react to the information when you do get it. And I think that we've got a very large challenge looming all the time. And the longer we let it go on, the greater the challenge will become, because they begin to feel, gee, we can beat the United States. And it's very encouraging to everybody that we don't want to encourage along those lines.
Jack Beatty, this stubborn difference in perspectives here, and we can hear it on both sides, the view Bernard Trainor's and Edward Atkinson's, but they're quite different. One saying, if we focus correctly, if we define the mission properly, this will do the job. And Donald Rumsfeld, very much along that line. And then another chorus saying, no, it's just a big, urgent job that has to be handled en masse right away. Let's not mess around here. Let's get in there in force.
I think the problem is that the Pentagon leadership sort of convinced itself that modern warfare was so different from anything we've had before that there a good case of shock and awe delivered on selected targets would wrap up the whole thing, that the people would welcome our troops with open arms, that it would be a cakewalk in somebody's view. Unfortunately, that provided us really insufficient combat units, even in the early stages. We took a lot of casualties along the supply lines there because they were unguarded. We ended up with units going into towns where they shouldn't have gone because we didn't have enough MPs out to direct them onto the right path.
We all watched that, and we're hearing tonight both yourself and Bernard Trainor saying, that moment right after the war, that when the aura of invincibility might have been the prevalent aura, that's lost. So let's get real with what's there. Jack, these two views just knocking heads here, refusing to stand down.
Well, I wonder if they don't share a common assumption that needs to be called into question, and that is that the military aspect of this is what's primary. It seems to me that what we need to do there is to reverse that premise and to put politics first, to stand up a government there just as fast as we can. That was the original idea. The first man that Rumsfeld sent out there, remember, said, I'm going to be gone in 3 months. Then they put that on hold, and they said, no, we have to stabilize the country first, then we can have the politics. But just as in the Israel-Palestine thing, you can't first say we're going to stabilize and then we'll have the politics, because inevitably that means you never stabilize.
But there's clearly fear about doing that, Jack. I mean, presumably at this point, if they could, they would put up an Iraqi government.
I'm not so sure about that. Why don't they want to stand up that government? Why don't they see that this is a way to legitimate the use of our force and to have to reinvigorate that demobilized Iraqi army, to give them more, in other words, to Vietnamize this, to use an expression, and to make it legitimate to the Iraqi people. Look, they have a problem now where if you cooperate with the U.S., you're liable to be assassinated. And the people who then tell that that's going to happen, our government says we can't protect the informers who are telling us about this.
Right.
We've got a real problem here. Put an Iraqi face on this just as soon as possible. Let patronage, let the
tools of politics work to isolate the hardcore foreign terrorists and to make this a more manageable proposition.
Bernard Traynor, you're talking about a mission definition and intelligence. Does getting an Iraqi government up and running figure into your assessment of how many troops are needed there?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. I think those comments were reasonable. You know, at the end of the war, at the end of the combat, the mission should have immediately changed to the what I call the three S's, the stability, security, and services. And we were sadly lacking on that. We get an A in terms of the combat operations and probably a D in that. And we lost control of the situation, and we're trying to play catch-up ball right now. And clearly, getting some sort of a political institution in place and operating, I think, is very, very important. But also the bureaucratic infrastructure that goes with us, and that's where I think we've made another mistake. I mean, we bombed ministry buildings, and which are probably unnecessary, and then we took out the entire bureaucratic infrastructure and the military infrastructure, which we probably could have made use of and keep them intact, and then, you know, have a gradual purging process of those that were part of the Ba'athist regime in a negative sense.
So
we didn't do that, but, I mean, there's no question of it. Right now, we still have to provide the three S's, and very quickly, insofar as we can, get the Iraqis to pick up the slack themselves.
But if things are as dicey, as urgent, I mean, but we're hearing that there's another window now, not that window of the aura of invincibility, but a period of time within which to prove that U.S. presence there can improve life. If that window is closing, if John McCain is right, what's the harm in or might we need to pour more troops in as we, you know, fiddle with the dials, as you suggest, to get the mission and intelligence gathering right?
Well, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have more forces in there. I'm just saying that people that tell you that we do need them without any legitimate basis for doing it, particularly when they start to say exactly how much, I don't know what's needed. I'm willing to accept the field commander. But you also have to understand, we're also talking about giving the government back to the Iraqis, and now we're pouring more forces in there, and that can be counterproductive.
Yep,
I mean, trying to keep a low profile and trying to show that the Iraqis are masters of their own fate, I think that's very important. So all I'm saying is that these unsophisticated, unjustifiable demands for more forces don't make any sense unless we really have defined the problem.
Well, and yet the problem spools out every day. Bernard Traynor, Edward Akerson, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about U.S. troop strength in Iraq and whether it needs to grow or not. Do we have enough U.S. troops to send more to Iraq? And if we don't, the bigger question, Michael O'Hanlon raised it earlier, do we need a bigger military? Is it time to go to the U.N., hat in hand, and say, please, help? And John McCain says, we're in a race against time in Iraq. Do you agree? Would more troops help us win the race or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. troop strength in Iraq and whether it needs to grow or not. You can join the conversation. What is the political landscape around this question? Can George Bush afford to send more troops, even if he should eventually want to? And what about back-to-back tours for U.S. troops? Is that inhumane, or may there be no choice out there? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, former retired Marine Corps three-star General Bernard Traynor, joining us from Lexington, Massachusetts. And from Alexandria, Virginia, Edward Atkinson, a major general in the U.S. Army, retired, now senior fellow at the Institute of Land Warfare Studies and senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We have a lot of callers who want to join, and I want to bring them in. Leo is calling from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think that it's virtually impossible for anybody on this part of the ocean, this side of the ocean, to be able to make any assessment as to whether we have enough or not. But it seems to me the fact that we are in fact debating it and asking whether we have enough or not is by definition admission that there isn't enough. Because if we did have enough resources there, We would be seeing it in the results. I agree with General Traynor's point on the mission. It is very important to have the mission and to have the resources deployed consistent with the mission. But one of the things that really needs to be talked about is the timeline that goes with the mission, and I'm not hearing too many people talk about that. The real thing that I want to bring up is the fact that I think this has the potential of turning into a real political hot potato, like Vietnam and like a lot of these other skirmishes that we've gotten involved in the past, being that it's an election year next year. And I'm just wondering, I'd like to ask the, your two folks what their opinion is on the on the possibility of this becoming a real political football, with some people saying we have enough and some people say we don't have enough.
Leo, let us pick that up. That's a great question. We heard earlier from Michael Hanlon saying that the whole question has become a kind of referendum, almost a proxy question about whether or not the war has been prosecuted effectively or not. Bernard Traynor, Edward Atkinson, let me put it to each of you. Bernard Traynor first. How do you imagine the politics factor in here? Take us inside the mind and the operations of the Pentagon. Will this be decided in a purely military manner, or is the advice going to come from the political side of the government, of the executive here, from Karl Rove?
Well, Tom, clearly there's a big political aspect of this, but I think we have to look beyond that. This is almost the same as World War II. We are in a war of survival. It's a war against terrorism, of which Iraq and the current situation is a subset. But it just so happens that under the circumstances, the cockpit of that war has now become Iraq, with the introduction of the anti-American forces from these various terrorist groups from the adjacent countries. We cannot make the decision on this on the basis of politics. It has to be a bipartisan approach, and regardless of the differences that may exist in specific points, there has to be a unified position on the part of the United States.
But are you confident?
With or without the UN, we cannot possibly lose in this situation, because if we lose there, the ripple effect is going to be disastrous.
And so far, I don't hear any dissent on that, and yet there is a lot of controversy right now about what the troop level, the troop strength ought to be. Are you confident that though this needs to be decided in an apolitical way, that it will be? Or are politics inevitably going to come into this decision? Are they in there already, Bernard Traynor?
Well, I think politics will come into it, but I would hope that that good sense would prevail and that people would focus on precise aspects of the problem, the same as involving the U.N. Yes, the U.N. would be very useful to be involved, but the point is that you say, in what sense? What precisely are they going to do? Are they just going to be bureaucrats, or are they going to be very, very useful? Defining the terms and the specific terms of reference are enormously important, and everybody seems to be glossing over that with a lot of rhetoric, both on both sides of the House and between the State Department and the Defense Department.
Yeah, I think I feel a kind of longing for more specificity here. People are frustrated by not knowing if it's going well or not well, if it's really working well with fewer troops, or if that in itself is a political position. Edward Atkinson, what's your sense of how politics are now or may in the presidential season factor into the big question of what the troop commitment ought to be in Iraq?
Well, I would agree with General Bernard Traynor that indeed we're at war. The problem is that we reacted to the wrong enemy. The Iraqis had nothing to do with the attack on the United States, and they have none of the qualities that we've impugned to them, such as weapons of mass destruction and so forth. We've simply gone off track in attacking people that we thought were bad. Now the real political aspect of the problem is that we've got a 10-ton elephant sitting in the middle of the living room that nobody can talk about, and that's the Palestinian Arab question. And it's a bleeding running sore there on the settlement of this this issue between who's going to have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip there.
And you see that question running straight into this issue?
The United States has got to play continue to play a very active and balanced role there, which we simply fade off to anytime somebody holds our feet to the fire.
Jack, I want to put the same question to you on the politics. We've got some interesting positions being taken here now. Democrats, Joe Biden, saying let's get a lot more troops in there. Some Republicans saying the same. Others lining up with Don Rumsfeld and George Bush. Is Joe Biden serious, or is he just trying to embarrass the president by saying we've got to put more troops in there when he knows how difficult that would be?
Well, he's not running for president. I think that's why he can say it.
But his party is.
It's a free shot for him, yes. But the candidates have been saying now for weeks, Kerry has been saying, Dean has been saying, I think Gephardt has been saying, we have to involve the UN. And that's an easy one for them. The polls show that's what the public wants to do. The obstacle to that is Donald Rumsfeld. And, you know, some people think that he effectively has the president under his thumb and that Ms. Rice does not serve the president well by arbitrating the fights between state and defense and even within defense. And, you know, Karl Rove can remember one thing about Mr. Rumsfeld, and that is that in 1976, when Henry Kissinger was in Moscow trying to negotiate a SALT agreement that would have reelected Gerald Ford, Donald Rumsfeld, as Secretary of Defense, was scuppering the agreement back here, undercutting Mr. Kissinger and effectively losing the election for Gerald Ford.
But throwing Donald Rumsfeld over would have an enormous political cost with it as well.
This is the
Secretary of Defense in wartime.
Right, but you got to stand up to him. And the president has got to stand up to him. There's no evidence that he has. And some people think that effectively Rumsfeld calls the shots. If he's going to go to the UN, he has to stand up to him. And the president cannot go to the election with two, three, four American boys dying every week. That will not go. The public, overwhelmingly through the 90s, shows it has no stomach for nation building, no stomach for occupations, and certainly no stomach for creeping Somalias.
But everyone seems to be on one page here tonight that the U.S. can't just walk away from this. Lou is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Lou. You're on the air.
Yes, my question is, I was in Vietnam in 67.
Yes.
And this is just the way it started in Vietnam. We can't lose it because if we do, the communists will take over the world. And then they get you in there and they keep adding troops. They keep adding troops. And then eventually you've got to cut and run because there's no win. You can't win a guerrilla war.
And you're hearing that same drumbeat in this conversation. It's a perspective that's... It's not fun at all, Lou, but we understand it. Edward Atkinson, let me put that to you. You hear exactly what's on Lou's mind.
Well, I was in Vietnam the same time he was, and so I really can't dispute anything he says in that regard. I do, however, feel that this is a more winnable war than what we had there. If we had the proper level of troop and effort, and we were able to freeze out the other players that are right now permitting their countries to be used for transit of additional guerrillas coming in, I think we could seal it and close it up and get an operating indigenous government going there.
So you're more hopeful.
I'm a little more optimistic about this than I ever was about Vietnam.
Well, we're glad for that. General Traynor, what about the specifics of how the UN might be brought into play here? Again, Michael O'Hanlon saying earlier, make this a UN job. Make Paul Bremer, the UN representative there, get NATO involved because you've got U.S. control there as well. Do you see a way that the UN could be involved that might bring more troops from other countries in that would, A, be effective, and, B, be palatable, be acceptable to Donald Rumsfeld?
Oh, sure. Well, I don't think it has to be acceptable to Rumsfeld. I think it has to be acceptable to the president. And I think that there are modalities that can be worked out. I think the issue breaks down into three categories. One is the military side of the house, and I think that's the easiest one to solve.
You mean the military would welcome UN involvement? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In other words, the same sort of a setup that we've had perhaps in Kosovo.
Kosovo. Mm-hmm.
With the UN involved, NATO involved, but under a single head. We had it in Korea, as a matter of fact. So the military side of the thing, I think everybody would subscribe to the U.S. being the unified commander because of its capabilities, amongst other things, plus the fact that they would have the preponderance of force. I don't think the military side is a problem. Then the second element of it is the humanitarian aspect of it. And the U.N. is very good at that. And indeed, the U.N. was involved in that when the disastrous event took place here this past week. But the third and the prickly one is the UN involved in the political and the reconstruction effort, other than the technical side. There you have to spell out the terms very, very precisely. The UN does not have a very good track record in that sort of thing. You know, they become calcified and send bureaucratic messages back and forth and are not particularly noted for being activists. But it's something that can be worked out with terms of reference. But instead of people just saying, well, let's get the UN involved, you have to define exactly what you mean by that and what the terms of reference are going to be. But I think all of these can be worked out, and I think the administration should not be reluctant to take that approach.
Though so far they're very publicly and unabashedly reluctant to do that, and they haven't even been willing, at least publicly, to get into spelling out situations or a circumstance in which they'd be ready to bring the UN in. Manuel is calling from Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Manuel. You're on the air.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that we are now in there. We should not look at whether we shouldn't have gone or we should have. That place needed to be cleaned up. What we need is more people in there so that the people of Iraq know that we are there for them.
On the phone.
Yeah.
But it's
the informants, and so we can increase our intelligence and let the terrorists and the criminals know that we mean business and so, we won't tolerate any such, you know, atrocities that are made on us or the people of Iraq.
So bring in the troops and let everybody know that we mean business, though we're hearing tonight there are many ways of doing that. General Akeson, at the end of this, we've just got a couple minutes left here. Do you see a way that we could just do things better and not necessarily lay on that great new slab of troops, that the escalation that you heard our Vietnam vet there fearing?
Well, I think that I'm a little more optimistic about what the UN would be able to do in there, particularly in guiding the NGO organizations that come in, than perhaps General Traynor is. I think that with respect to the UN, what you have to look out for is that you don't end up with just a United Nations command structure such as we had in the former Yugoslavia, where, for example, you had a Dutch battalion that was charged with defending Srebrenica, and then the Serbs just said, get out of the way, and they did, and we had a terrible butchery there.
And General Traynor, let me one last question to you. Could we lose this war, this situation?
Indeed, we could. We could tire of it. The American people could tire of it, and we could quit and get out. The British have done that from time to time, simply that it wasn't supportable back home after a period of time.
Given the stakes that are at play at this particular point in the overall war on terror, defeat is not an option.
It may not be an option, but how to avoid it seems to be, even here tonight, as yet unresolved. General Edward Atkinson in Alexandria, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure.
And General Bernard Traynor, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, Bernard Traynor's right. There are many details there. And yet the big question remains, more troops or not? And it still sits here unresolved. And John McCain says the clock is ticking, folks.
Yes, and earlier General Atkinson brought up post-war reconstruction, you know, that we tried a political revolution in the South to stand up democracy. The North tired of it. It betrayed the South in 1877. It betrayed black people in 1877. And the South got back what it wanted. Effectively, the North lost, and 600,000 lives were sacrificed.
Well, a victory in the long, long run. Who knows if we have time for that this time. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.